And this, of course, is the interactive portion of the program. We will take your phone calls when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Dennis D'Souza with us here this hour as we take your calls. Dennis, how did you get involved in movie making?
Well, I've been a writer of books and a speaker most of my life, and then I got the idea of making a documentary film. In fact, I was surfing the internet, and I noticed that Obama had read his own book, Dreams from My Father, in audiobooks. And so I thought this is a very vivid account by Obama of his own life. And I thought it would be cool to put it to music, so to speak, put it into a movie where people could hear him talk in his own words, from the horse's mouth, so to speak. I also remember that Michael Moore, of course, had made Fahrenheit 9/11 and dropped it in the middle of the 2004 election. And I thought, you know, if that guy can do it, I think I can do it.
And you did.
And I did.
Did you have fun doing it?
Well, I was under the illusion that, you know, Hollywood controls the distribution of films, which is actually not true. The studios make films, but it's companies like Regal and Cinemark and AMC that distribute them. It was tough to make a movie the first time around because I didn't know what I was doing. But I realized that it's a very powerful medium. In a book, for example, you appeal to the intellect. But in a movie, you need to have an argument, yes. But you also need to entertain, and you need to be able to sway people emotionally. So you're, in a sense, engaging not simply their mind, but also them visually, orally. You're kind of engaging all their senses at the same time. And so in that sense, the impact of a movie is much more overwhelming.
So when you got into debates with the Hitchens and the Dawkins types, were you able to convince them at all about the other side?
Well, I think I was able to show them that what they believed to be something that was demonstrably the result of reason was in fact not so. That in fact there's powerful arguments on both sides and that there's no monopoly on reason on the part of the atheist. The atheist somehow thinks that he's somehow got a patent on reason, and that's simply not so. Both the atheist and the believer are struggling with the great mysteries of life, trying to make sense of it, and both of them are trying ultimately to figure out a way to live well and to develop a sense of how do we understand the world better. Do we understand the world as a product of random forces that just came together and here we are, or is there some creative intelligence behind it? No answer is automatically right. You have to look at the evidence.
Okay, let's take some calls here for you. This hour will fly by. We've got Bob in Greenwood, California to get things started here on the Wild Card Line. Bob, go ahead.
Good evening.
Hi.
Hi. I first wanted to say I respect Mr. D'Souza's work, and I wanted to say that I worked for the federal government for 25 years. I was a federally protected whistleblower for over two decades. There's a degree of incompetence that's involved just because of the size and the bloating and all of that. But on a leadership level, you cannot tell me that we have gone through the 40 years we've had of the Bush-Clinton, Obama dynasty, and from a leadership perspective, the things that have been allowed and been encouraged to have happened have not been done on purpose and is not some part of a larger structure. I just find that mind-boggling that you can combine that with your knowledge of what happened on 9/11 and at the same time not draw some conclusion that there's leadership issues here.
Well, I think that there are leadership issues, and I do think that the Obama, you may call it the unmaking of America. Obama calls it the remaking of America, but the way I look at it, how do you do a remaking without unmaking, right? If I'm trying to remake a bridge, I've got to take down the bridge that's there now. So Obama is changing America at the very least. He has a different view of America. And Bush, of course, had many of his own problems. Bush was a promiscuous big spender. Bush, I think, burned the Republican brand to a degree. Bush, I think, made a terrible mistake, a blunder, in invading Iraq while claiming there were weapons of mass destruction, which there weren't. So all of this has been damaging to America's image. I'm not an apologist for Bush, but I do think Obama has taken us to a new low. And I don't think that this is a matter of conspiracy. This is just Obama's ideology.
What do you think of Vladimir Putin? What's your reaction about him?
Well, my thing about Putin is that I think Putin is a guy who came in and saw the debris of the old Soviet Empire, and it shamed him. And he began to think, what is the way I can put this back together? Here we have this empire stretching across 10 time zones. We terrified the United States. We had the world's largest nuclear arsenal. And suddenly, overnight, we were nothing. So Putin, I think, is attempting to restore Russia, at least to the prestige it had in the days of the Tsars. I don't think he can get back the old empire, the old Soviet empire, but he's certainly trying to put the Soviet bear back on the prowl.
Yeah, and he seems to be doing a strangely good job of that, Dinesh, huh?
Well, he's doing a strangely good job only because we are doing such a terribly bad job. I mean, any country like the United States should be saying, all right, we recognize that China is gaining power because becoming richer and it's modernizing its nuclear arsenal. It could put 100 million men in the battlefield. Russia is coming up. So America has allies. India is today probably the most pro-American country in the world. America has Japan, Korea. So common sense would dictate that America should strengthen its alliances with Japan, Korea, and India to arrest the growing power of Russia and China. But you notice that we're making almost no efforts, no serious efforts in that direction.
When we got Osama bin Laden, you know, there he was living right next to a Pakistani military camp and in the middle of a city in a town. How could he be there for so many years and not get noticed? Or did he?
Utterly mysterious how that is the case. You know, I've never understood. I mean, in the 90s, after the bombings of the USS Cole, after the attacks on our embassies, the whereabouts of bin Laden, now this is before 9/11, but were known. I mean, this is a guy who would give sermons in the mosque in Kabul. He was interviewed by Peter Arnett of CNN. He was interviewed by Time magazine. And so the Clinton administration knew exactly where he was. And yet somehow, you know, we didn't get him. We didn't even go arrest him. And then after 9/11, it took an awful long time for a country that has the intelligence resources we do, intelligence resources that we're now using to spy on our own citizens. But it certainly did take us a long time to find bin Laden, although I'm glad we did.
Edward Snowden, hero or traitor?
I think the verdict is it's too early to say for sure, because we don't know. I mean, there's an open question. Has Snowden, for example, been trading American secrets to foreign powers? I mean, he's sitting there in Russia. I don't believe he has, and I have no reason to believe that he is doing anything like that. And he may very well just be a patriot who's recognized that our government has been accumulating secretly, by the way, by lying to the American people and lying to Congress, dossiers on every American. So these are not Americans who are suspected of spying or people who have been going on terrorist websites. These are Americans who are suspected of no crime whatsoever. And it's very dangerous, I think, in a free society to give our government that kind of power, power that can be used to all kinds of nefarious ends.
I think his reputation in this country would have been stronger, Dinesh, if he had stayed and not fled. What do you think?
I'm sure that's true. But, you know, here you have a young guy who's blown the whistle. And look, I mean, I can tell you from my own personal experience that it's rather difficult, unpleasant, and a little terrifying to have the feds going after you. They have enormous resources. They're willing to use almost any kind of tactics. And these are people who would seek to put this guy away for life, if not to execute him. So in some ways, I can kind of understand why he thinks, listen, I'm going to blow the whistle, but I'm going to skip town while I'm doing it.
When did you realize that they started to come after you?
Well, I realized it basically when the FBI began to interview people and produce bank records and so on. They clearly had already swept through all this kinds of stuff. Part of the mystery here is how this all got started. I mean, look, you have election violations of huge magnitude, and they go undetected. In my particular case, one of the FBI officials was quoted saying, we were doing a routine review, but it was evidently a routine review that produced a single offender, namely me. So this is why there are some people who have speculated, gee, you know, Dinesh is such a prominent critic of the Obama administration that they have had him in their sights for a long time. I tried as part of my trial to get the judge to open the file because the government has the file, but the judge declined to do it. And so the information about how they decided to prosecute me, who made that decision, et cetera, remains in a closed file in the possession of the United States government.
First-time caller, Jim, in Marina Del Rey in California. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Yes, I've been listening for about the last hour to this guy, and he says that Republicans have been so picked on by the government and everybody else, yet they're handing them out millions of our tax dollars and our investment money. They make it impossible for us to get money. They give it away to the banks that waste it on themselves, or they just stick it in bank accounts across the ocean or in private accounts, and they don't lend it out to us. They pay us a stinking 1% interest rate on it. I think it's the middle class and the poor people are getting ripped off big time by the Republicans, which are most of these guys that are doing these kind of things. With all these different investment plans they have to steal from poor retired people. I'm just getting really fed up with it. And I think that's what most Americans really think that I talk to.
All right, Dinesh, what say you on that?
Well, he's got half a point. And what I mean by that is that these egregious bailouts, which are completely morally unjustifiable, this notion of handing out to failing companies government money is absolutely atrocious. And it did begin under the Bush years. But here's an interesting mystery. We're 6 years into the Obama administration, which is supposed to be fighting for the little guy. So why did the Obama administration say, you know what, now that we're here, we're going to continue these bailouts? In fact, there are banks that went to the Obama administration and said, we're ready to pay back our bailout. We don't want it. And the Obama administration said, absolutely not. We insist you keep the bailout. You know why? Because that way the government gets to continue to control these private corporations. And that's how Obama gets to fire the head of General Motors. So what's been going on here is, you know, in all these policies, you have to look a little bit below the surface. Let me give the example of Obamacare, because the caller probably thinks, wow, you know, Obama's fighting for me. You know, Obama pretends like he's colluding with the American people against the insurance companies. But you just have to watch a little more closely with Obamacare, and you see it's the opposite. Obama's colluding with the insurance companies against the American people. Now, how does that work? Well, Obama goes to the insurance companies, and he says, listen, guys, you know, I've got a great deal for you. I'm going to force every American, whether they like it or not, to buy health insurance. And that means that because then the market, the number of people who have to buy insurance is now much larger. And that means much bigger profits for the insurance company. So the bottom line of it is both parties here have their hands dirty with making these kinds of bailout deals. But I think it's rather interesting that the policies begun by Bush have been assiduously continued by Obama.
That I find to be bizarre. I mean, it was almost like a torch handoff in a race. You know, one guy starts it, the other one continues it. It's going to be interesting to see what happens when the next person comes in, Dinesh.
Right, but I think what makes it doubly interesting, see, nobody is puzzled when the Republicans support business, right? Because the Republicans are supposed to be the party of
Yeah, everybody
business.
Expects
The puzzle is
that.
Why the Obama guys would do it.
Well, that tells you maybe they're all the same.
That tells you that maybe they're all the same, or that tells you that maybe that the so-called progressives, while pretending to fight big business, have their own agenda, which is government control of the private sector.
That could be. Let's go back to the calls. We'll go to Greg in Gary, Indiana, wildcard line. Greg, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, guys. I'm also a big supporter of Dinesh D'Souza. I think your 2016 movie is becoming more and more eerily prophetic. But to kind of piggyback on what you guys were just talking about, it seems like both parties are culpable. And I wouldn't have thought this 5 or 10 years ago in what's going on. And there really is no opposition to this. I think the progressives have taken over both parties. And when someone does try to stand up against this, they're demonized, they're vilified, you included. And I think the support for my hypothesis is going to be if we're looking at a Hillary Clinton, Jeb Bush 2016 election. I'd like to get your comment.
Well, I think that one of the reasons, and this is a theme I do explore in the forthcoming movie, America, and it's this, that while the Republicans are in a huddle trying to figure out how do we take back the Senate, how do we fight this battlefield, what the Republicans don't realize is that the battlefield is vastly bigger than they think. The left has been making a long march through the institutions of elementary and secondary education, academia, Hollywood, the media, National Public Radio, the mainline churches. So they've been capturing the commanding heights of the culture while the Republicans are sort of asleep or at least fighting in one corner of the battlefield. Now, in 2016, we made some very specific predictions about Obama. One of the predictions I made is that America's power would continue to wane in the world. Obama would strengthen our enemies and would weaken our allies. And we've seen one by one American allies topple in places like Egypt. I also predicted Obama would promiscuously expand the national debt. And here's a remarkable fact. This man has, within 6 years, doubled the national debt. The national debt, about $8.5 trillion when he came into office, now over $17 trillion. That's a remarkable, I would say, negative, but accomplishment of a certain kind. So, yeah, I think we're living in a strange moment in which the American people, who generally stay away from politics, are finally, slowly, belatedly waking up. And I think they need to wake up to take back their country.
Now, we're never going to be able to handle that kind of debt. So where are we headed? What's going to happen? Some say, some experts we've had on the program, Dinesh, say that we're going to have a bubble burst worse than 2008. What do you think?
Well, countries sometimes decline and countries sometimes collapse. We always like to think that if there's going to be decline, it's going to be slow and rather comfortable and will take an awfully long time. But the example of the Soviet Union shows that that's not the case. That decline can sometimes accelerate, and unexpectedly something that seemed invincible, there forever. When I was, you know, when I came to America at the age of 17, this was 1978, I thought the Soviet Union was going to last for another century. I thought if we could get those guys out of Afghanistan, that would be an amazing accomplishment. Little did I know that literally, a few years later, the Berlin Wall would come crashing down, Eastern Europe would be free, the Communist Party would vote to abolish itself. All of this happened with breathtaking rapidity. We still haven't even fully digested it. So America has to be careful. We've got this great American formula, and we know how great it is because other countries are now running with it. So here's India, here's China. They're going the free market capitalist road. Hundreds of millions of people are climbing out of poverty. So I love to see the way in which the American formula is liberating the world, but it's in a way so sad that right here in America we're losing the recipe that we came up with.
How fast are we losing it? Rapidly?
I think pretty rapidly. I mean, we've seen remarkable decline just in the last decade or so. I mean, it's remarkable for me to see the way in which the middle class has lost the American dream. Kids who are graduating, even from very fine colleges, are working, in essentially menial jobs with no hope of actually really getting a job that is a career. It's almost like these people are now drifting into a kind of idle world in which they play with their phone and they do this and they do that, but they're not really productive, contributing members of society, and they're not fired by the same kind of entrepreneurial enthusiasm that built this country into what it is.
And we're going to come back in just a moment with you, Dinesh, but if people want more information on you, you've got a couple websites out. We've got links for you, but do you have a special website, or are they both okay?
Well, I direct people to americathemovie.com, and also my website, just DineshDeSouza.com, if I can spell it, DineshDeSouza.com. Watch the trailer there for our film, and read my book. The book is a kind of the intellectual spine for the coming film, and it lays out in a more detailed fashion than a film can the argument about where America is now, how we got here, and what are some of the forces that are pulling us down.
We're going to come back and take final phone calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, they say when strange events occur, it is truly beyond belief, and that's the name of our television program, which you can look at for free for 10 days. But while you're looking at it, look at all the other videos that are available out there. Simply go to this website, sign up for it, www.beyondbelief.com. Welcome back, Dinesh D'Souza with us. Dinesh, is this all fixable, or should we just throw our arms in the air and go, there's nothing we can do?
Oh, no, I certainly don't believe that. Abraham Lincoln once said that America is ruled by public opinion. Now, he did not mean by this that America is ruled by the opinions of the public, because the American public, by and large, is apathetic, is disengaged, is involved in politics once every 2 or 4 years, and then if it isn't raining. So what Lincoln actually meant is that there's a smaller group of people. I'd estimate that group to be about 100,000. And these are the people who are involved in politics hands-on. They're delegates or bloggers or they're lobbyists. They're people in some way who remain actively involved in the process. And these are the people who really shape American politics. They set the goalposts within which every politician must move. Now, the progressive transformation of America was brought about by a relatively small number of people, and a relatively small number of people who are equally smart, equally well-organized, and equally determined can undo this unmaking, if you will, of America. So I don't think that this is a case where you need got to say, oh, gee, we need 45 million people to do what we need to do. No, we need a much smaller group of people, but people who are intelligent about the battlefield and are willing to engage and are brave.
Well, I hope you're right. I hope you're right on all of that. In terms of what happens next for you with the campaign finance pleading, what's going to happen?
I don't know exactly what's going to happen, but the fact of the matter is whatever is going to happen isn't going to slow me down or deter me from being outspoken. And in some ways, I think this has even emboldened me to be even more candid and perhaps even aggressive. In being able to speak out and say, listen, America, is this something that we actually want to happen? Do we want to see Lady Justice sort of slip off her blindfold, wink at her friends, cast the evil eye at her enemies? I mean, this is a new low. I don't see Clinton or Carter, and, you know, Democrats, though they might have been, trying to use the instruments of the state against people who disagree with them. So we've sort of turned a corner in American politics, and we should stop this before it gets too far.
Okay, back to the calls now that we have with the time remaining. Shannon in Toronto, Canada. Hi, Shannon, go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hello, Shannon.
How are you? Hi, I'm going to buy your book. What's the website again?
It's linked up for you.
My website is just called Dinesh D'Souza.com.
And it's linked up for you, Shannon, at coasttocoastam.com. You just click there. There's a direct link to his website.
Perfect. And the reason I'm calling is because I'm in Toronto, Canada, and we have a huge election coming tomorrow, and I really, really want people to vote NDP. I wanted to tell people that.
Well, all right. Very good. Now, how about a question? Anything?
Not really. No, I've just been really campaigning because I'm sick of I don't like our politics. Like, I'm sure you've heard of Rob Ford.
Oh, we've heard of that situation. Yeah.
Okay, this is a huge election. It really, really is. So I've been campaigning. People need to vote NDP. Not Liberal, not PC, because they're not great. So please vote NDP tomorrow.
Okay, good luck, Shannon. There you go, a little political plug. Jeff is in Goldsboro, North Carolina, though. Jeffrey, go ahead.
Hi, Dinesh. Hi, George. How are you doing this evening?
Good, Jeff.
My question is to you, Dinesh, on where do you think we should be going with the manned space program? What should be our goals and funding? Are we funding it too little? Are we funding it too much? Are we funding it just right? George Bush wanted to go back to the moon, but then he didn't give us any funding for it. Obama wants an asteroid retrieval mission, but that's been lukewarmly received. Duke Gingrich wanted to go back to the moon, but he got ridiculed by both sides. So what's your take on that? Where should we be going with the manned space program and the funding for it?
You know, I'm not sure I know the answer to that, but what I do see as I look around the world is that the enthusiasm for space, which once was drove the United States. Now, true, we were provoked into it by the success of Sputnik. But nevertheless, we beat the Russians at their own game. We put a man on the moon. And then we have seen now in the last decade and a half or so, the leadership, it seems, moving away from the United States and toward China and Russia. It may be that the future of space is not so much in government projects to do this or do that, but in privately funded space missions. So introducing something that we might have thought impossible going back to the 70s and 60s, which is entrepreneurialism in the area of space. One of the problems with the government doing this stuff is that they make a call, they put hundreds of billions of dollars behind it, and it may be the wrong call. So ideally, what you'd like to see is entrepreneurial ventures, some of which would work, some of which would produce new knowledge. Others might fail. But that way, we at least get a testing mechanism in place to see where the most promising avenues are for the future.
Okay, very good. Dinesh, as you move forward with what you're doing, the movies, the books, and everything else, project out for me 5 years from now, what will you be writing about? What will America be like then?
Well, I think America has a very bright future because America has brought something very new into the world. Let me put it this way. For millennia, human beings were driven by a single ethic, and that is the ethic of conquest. The ethic of conquest dominated the world. The borders of most countries have been set by conquest. We sometimes say, you know, the white man came and took the country from the Native Americans. But wait a minute. Pretty much every Native American tribe that was in possession of land when the white man came had, in fact, taken that land from some other tribe some decades or centuries earlier. So the ethic of conquest was going on everywhere. Now, what America brought into the world is a rival ethic, which is the ethic of consent, of self-determination, of equal rights, and of wealth creation. And what I mean by that is that, you know, you can get wealth in two ways, by taking it, by conquering it, by grabbing it from someone else, or by making something new. And I mentioned earlier Steve Jobs. Now, he took, you know, grains of sand and converted them into silicon. He invented something new. He didn't make anybody poorer because of what he did. He wasn't stealing anybody else's marbles. So America has represented these new things in the world. Like I say, the rest of the world now recognizes, wow, what a great recipe, and they're running with it. So in some sense, even if America goes down, the American formula will still live. But of course, for me, having, you know, left India and come to America, having voted with my feet in favor of this country and this dream, it'll be a real pity for me to see this American dream subside in the place where it was manufactured.
We go to Houston, Texas. Gary is with us on Coast to Coast. Gary, thank you for calling. You are up.
Yes, Dinesh mentioned Paschal's wager, which I wanted to quote, which is very short, but I first wanted to say that he made a most profound point that I've used many times about atheists and religious. There is nobody living on Earth that can possibly confirm or deny the existence of an afterlife, and no atheist can know it, and no religious person can know it, only the dead know. And Paschal's wager was, if there is no God and you don't believe in God, you lose nothing. If there is no God and you believe in God, you lose nothing. If there is a God and you don't believe in God, you lose everything. And if there is a God and you believe in God, you win everything. That's Paschal's wager.
Well said.
Thank you.
That's a beautiful summary of it. Yes.
Okay.
All right, very good. Let's go to Jeff in Juneau, Alaska now. Get a question out of you, Jeffrey. Go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Dinesh, you know, I have to admit that I tuned in a little late and you were speaking, and I thought, how odd, Miki Okaku is on the air with George, and he's talking about stuff he doesn't normally talk about. You sound exactly like him on the radio. I just had to get that out. Anyway, I kind of wanted I'm listening to the other callers that were before me, and I think I'm going to sum up. I don't think the argument is between Republicans and Democrats. I think it's between the constitutional conservatives and progressive liberals, and I think that needs to be made the point, because yeah, there's plenty of Republicans that fit the progressive bill just as much as the Democrats do. I mean, they're peas in a pod, if you know what I mean. And I just wanted to say I am so inspired by your love for America. I wish more people that were born here had that same attribute that you put off, because it just inspires me. And I'm kind of an entrepreneur myself. I've invented some. I have a board game that I invented, and I'm
trying to get
that
on
the market and everything.
As long as it's not a Ouija board, huh?
No, George, nothing like that. It's an abstract strategy game. It's similar to chess, but it's not. It's apples and oranges.
Well, good for you. entrepreneurial yeah. ship.
And
like
so
that.
I wanted to also ask this question. You bring up the spiritual side, and you talked about God and all of that. And I just have to ask you, my belief about God is that there certainly is a God. There certainly is an afterlife, but I don't nail it down to one religion or another. And I just think anyone who realizes that we, and you mentioned about the thing about, I don't know if you were saying that you don't believe this or not, but you mentioned this idea about us all being one. I think we're all little sparks of the same God. And plenty of guests that come on Coast to Coast to, you know, echo this, as George will tell you. And I think that listening to Coast to Coast over the last 20 years has really shaped what I believe about that. And I just wanted to kind of get your feedback, because I really respect what you have to say. And I really wanted to hear you out on that.
Well, I'd like to make one quick thought on two very different topics that you raised. First of all, on the topic of God, we got to remember that religions are man-made, and none of us has the God's eye view. It's almost like we're standing, all of us, at the feet of a very tall mountain, and there's streams of water coming down from the top, but none of us knows which is the highest stream. The different religions are sort of human efforts to apprehend, to understand the source of those streams. And they're sort of speculative guesses. They may be very good guesses, but nevertheless, they are guesses about what the ultimate truth is. So I think we should be humble about this, recognize the fallibility of human knowledge, try to learn from each other, learn from the atheists as well when they're making a good point. On a different note, you mentioned me being an immigrant. Now, the immigrant is in a very unique position because the immigrant can see America from the inside, but also from the outside. So you have a sort of double perspective, a stereoscopic sort of view of America. Now, I find that Americans sometimes, you know, bitterly turn against their own country because they measure America against a utopian standard. They find that America falls short compared to what? Well, compared to, like, the Garden of Eden. Now, the immigrant, on the other hand, uses a historical or comparative basis. The immigrant always realizes America may fall short, but America may still do better than every other existing country, either now or in the past. So the immigrant is always comparing America to some other existing society. And as a result, I think the immigrant is more realistic. The immigrant realizes that you have to vote ultimately in favor of this society and against that society. One reason, if America were to take down its borders, half the world would flood right in here. And that alone is a full refutation of the progressive critique, because if America was so terrible, why would everybody be wanting to break down the doors to get here?
Yeah, exactly. And how do you feel about that, Dinesh? I mean, here you are. You came from India. You know, children flocking across the border. I mean, what are we going to do about this?
Well, you know, it's funny because when I went to college, I kept hearing all this nonsense about, you know, cultural relativism and all cultures are basically equal. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, if all cultures are basically equal, why would people ever leave home and leave their own family and their own society to which they have a natural allegiance and move to another culture? Why would they do that? Unless they were fundamentally convinced that at least for them, this new culture was somehow better. So the immigrant is a walking refutation of cultural relativism and is voting in the most decisive way possible against his or her own culture and in favor of American society.
Let's take one or two more calls. Wiz in Honolulu. Hey, Wiz, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, George, how you doing? Long time listener. This
Good.
Is Wiz Hope Sepp out here in Honolulu, Hawaii.
Great. Thank you.
Just touching a few things. I just wanted to combine this God issue back to what he was saying about Snowden and our freedoms and liberties. You know, in all the Federal Reserve notes and in all the coins, it says, "In God we trust." Now, how do we know about God? If, aside from my parents and relatives, we know it from sort of scripture, you know, scriptures for all religions. That's how we know spiritually and religiously about a creator. So from that, we're supposed to have faith. And through that faith, the creator provides for us. There's a heaven and hell if we do good, if we repent. So that means he's our protector. You know what I mean? The Almighty is basically providing our security. So back to the government and the government's overreaching hand. All these three-lettered acronym government agencies that were created out of 9/11. You know, why do we need all that if we truly trust in the Creator? We're all seen as criminals. We're all seen as potential threats. Okay, just like back to the Native Americans, where he just said. I mean, I'm just adding on. I really don't have a specific question for your guest, but, you know, there's good things and bad things I've heard him say. I agreed, I disagreed. But, you know, it's just when it comes down to it, our government is not doing anything for us other than a little bit just making an appearance that they're doing something for us. Has your life really gotten better from one president to another, locally or federally? We're still in the same mess, you know? And if we really trust in the Almighty Creator, as Muslims say, Allahu Akbar, God's great, as Native Americans say, the Great Spirit, if we really trust in this God, then that's what we should be doing, not trusting in the government. Because we already know we're just pawns in a chess game.
Final reaction here, Dinesh.
I think if we look at the roots of America, you know, we sometimes have this debate about is America a Christian nation, and did was Thomas Jefferson an Orthodox Christian, and did George Washington go to church, and so on. To me, the issue is really this, that the principles of Christianity, and more broadly of theism, of transcendence, are the very basis for our human dignity, for equality, for the notion of rights. Now, here's Thomas Jefferson, who was actually not that religious and not very Orthodox. But nevertheless, when the American founders said, okay, Thomas Jefferson, go tell us where our rights come from, he could only think of one source, the Creator. And so the very notion that we are created equal is at the core of the American experiment. We're clearly not equal in size or strength or speed, not even intellectual ability, maybe not even in moral character. But the fact that we're equal in the eyes of God, that's where we get our equality, our human dignity, and all our rights from.
Dinesh, good luck with everything that you're doing. Good luck with your legal issues there. And what would you recommend to Americans who may find themselves in the same situation that you're in?
Well, I would recommend that Americans recognize that that their government is not as scary as it seems at first glance. And the challenges that we face are challenges that we are completely up to. The American character is an immigrant character. This country has been built by restless, entrepreneurial, brave, and adventurous people. That spirit is still there in America, even though there's been an effort to push it down. It's very much there. And so part of what I want my work to do, this new book, America, my film, America, is to activate the spirit of 1776, because I think that's the spirit that will bring America back.
Dinesh D'Souza, all of his information at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back, Coral Castle and the remarkable late Edward Leeds Skolnick.